Call meeting to order. And I want to just real quick discuss our goal and our mission here. And that is to research and learn as much as we can about the funding mechanisms for school facilities, construction as well as maintenance, to look at what is working and what is not working, and to possibly come up with alternative options or solutions to better address the problems that we find that are out there. So where we're going to start today is to discuss where the current situation is, what is currently happening, discussing as many possibilities or options that schools have. If a school, for example, decides, the school board decides they need to build a new facility, what steps do they have to go through, what options do they have, and look at as many of those options as there are. I know that there are some programs that provide state aid and there are some that do not, but let's just look at as many different options as there are currently out there, as well as what hoops they have to jump through to get any of those options to work. So that's what we're going to look at today. And so we'll turn it over to the two of you to present as much information as you can of the current situation, please.
Very good. Well, Greg and I have put together some packets for you that should be in your folder.
Yeah.
And whenever you'd like to do this first with Greg and I, what we thought we could use as an outline is a chapter of the school finance guide that talks about capital finance, school building finance, and then we've got individual handouts on each of the programs, individual printouts essentially on each of the programs. And what we thought by presenting you this information is we could give you a better sense of where some of the issues are, what directions you want to go after we sort of bring you up to speed on the basics of each of these programs. So, you know, make this as informal as you like, and just let us know if we're spending too little or too much time on any particular subject. In terms of the overall situation in Minnesota, we tend to be a very strong local control state, and that means that we don't have a state architect, for example. We don't have state building plans that school districts need to follow. On the facilities front, essentially, we tell school districts, you figure out where you're going to site that building, you figure out who's going to build that building for us, you figure out what kind of standards, if any, that building will have in terms of energy efficiency or length of time that the building's going to run. The only thing we'll have is a small review and comment process at the department level. Then, essentially, we'll make your voters pay for it through a local property tax, with some amount of state assistance. And that's how the vast majority of building projects are done in Minnesota. And let's spend just a minute talking about this review and comment process. There are a couple of handouts that probably should have had Shannon put in the packet for you that I didn't really think about until a little bit ago. I'll hand this one out to you first. Yeah, we're going to start on that one that says capital finance, and then we'll go to all these little handouts. The one I just handed out to you is the list of the elections that are being held today, essentially. All the bolded ones on this list, starting with the Albany School District on down through the St. Francis School District listed as
federal board. Building projects?
These are all building projects. There's 20-some elections today, and I thought we could use these as an example of how the department goes through the review and comment process for this. If you just look at the first bolded one on the list, that's the Albany School District. And you can see there that they want to do some additions, essentially upgrade some electrical things like that. They've got a $13 million project. And so what they'll do during the review and comment is they'll send their plans off to the Department of Education. And the department will take a rather cursory look at this. They don't have many staff to do in review and comment. They'll make sure that some of the basic criteria that are in the review and comment statute are met. And then they'll give the project one of three ratings. They'll give it a positive review and comment if it essentially meets the statutory criteria, They'll give it an unfavorable review and comment if they're concerned about it, or if it absolutely doesn't meet the state statute, they'll give it a negative review and comment.
Can you give us an idea what kind of stuff is in that state statute? Is it that they actually need it, or that they're meeting building code, or what type of criteria?
Yeah, very little on that kind of criteria. Most of it is, have they contacted their neighboring school districts? Are they going to have they made enrollment projections, that kind of thing. So very little of the review and comment is really, is this adequate for educational purposes? Is this the right kind of facility? Is this an energy efficient facility? None of those are really part of the review and comment. There are some very small technical areas like the commissioning of the facility, which is when the energy systems get turned on, making sure they work as they're expected. But the review and comment doesn't really get to whether, you know, is it sensible to build the school out of brick, or should it be on a block, or is it really needed in that area versus 20 miles over? It's not that kind of project, and this gets back to that local control issue. We have a very lax process. If the East Central School District, for example, decides that they needed a new school in Sandstone, like they did a few years ago, well, that's their decision to make. If Edina decides they want a new elementary school, even if it's 1-3 miles away in Hopkins, it's going to be the Edina School Board to make that decision. And so the department has a little bit of authority with this review and comment to say, well, we don't think that's such a good idea, but they don't have much to fall back on. For example, there are some schools in rural Minnesota where the number of kids probably doesn't justify building a new building. The department really can't say no to them as long as that criteria has been met, that they've contacted the neighboring district, they've said what they're going to do, and they've essentially got an estimate of what's happening on their enrollment.
So if they do that, they get a positive rating, which some voters may interpret as, oh, I guess the state thinks we need to do this, even though that isn't really what it means.
Well, I think that's part of it, yeah. I mean, that's certainly part of it. Part of it is, though, that the state is unwilling. The legislature has not set for the department a role that they want them to play a different role there. They haven't said, we really want you to decide whether a new school is needed in one of these communities, or we want you to really work on efficiency and make sure we don't overbuild. So we're really leaving it to the local districts. The department has a great big thick book, I should have brought a copy of it with it, that's called Guidelines for School Construction. And this document talks about square footage in the classroom. Have it right there. This talks about all sorts of stuff, but it's not a rule and it's not statute. It doesn't have the force of law. It's a guidebook that the department likes to beat schools over the head with to try and get them to comply, but it doesn't have the force of law. So, and one of the areas you'll hear this a lot, there sometimes are disputes about whether a school's got sufficient amount of acreage for a new school site. When you hear those conflicts arise, those aren't about a rule or a law. Those are about a guideline in the school finance guidelines that the department, or school construction guidelines that the department has. And it's an odd way of doing business. It may be something you want to think more about. There are a lot of reasons for and against having more specific guidelines that are actually state rules, but these ones aren't. So the department can waive the document at a community meeting. They can say to Wilmer, that site's too small to rebuild a school. You need to build it at the edge of town where there's enough acreage for parking and where the buses can flow through well and that kind of thing. But they don't have the force of law behind them when they say that. It's their good idea, sort of a best practices recommendation, and nothing more. Another example of this review and comment process, the Duluth School District, and we'll probably get into this at a later date, is doing a fairly substantial as a proposal for a fairly substantial amount of building construction and repair under the lease purchase program, and there's special authority for them not to go to the voters if it's for deep fake purposes. The Department of Education just on Friday of last week issued a positive review and comment for them to proceed with about two-thirds of that plan. But that's another example where the review and comment's only a couple pages long. It's not a detailed look at, is each one of these projects necessary? Does it make sense to bring the school up to the standard they're saying? It's rather sort of looking more specifically at some very general statutes about whether they've met these broad outlines.
Okay. So I see here towards the bottom of that paragraph that if the commissioner submits a negative review and comment, the school board cannot proceed with the project.
That's right.
Okay. Has that happened very often or at all?
It has happened, as I understand it, it's happened a couple of times in the last 30 years, but it's very rare, and part of that is the department likes to work with districts to get a facility that makes sense. So they'll threaten that we're going to give you a negative review and comment if you don't do X, if you go ahead and remodel that building instead of building new. They'll threaten that, but it's very rare that they actually issue the negative review and comment. Okay. And instead, the superintendent takes the threat back to the community, or the board takes the threat back and says, the department's going to do this unless we do something else. So even though that that club is there, it's very rare that the commissioner uses that club.
Right. Thank you.
So that's the process that most of the building construction projects go through. Essentially, any project, as the middle of the page points out, about any project with a cost of more than $500,000 has to be submitted for review and comment. And anything more than $100,000, the district still needs to consult with the department for a review and comment. And basically, that's going to be any major building project anymore at those levels.
Right. Were these numbers established years and years ago so that when they were established, they were doing some building without it? Or
you know, they have not changed much. The $500,000 limit, I believe, was $200,000 about 15 years ago. Does that seem right?
So it has increased.
That one has increased, but I don't think the $100,000 minimum has increased much over time.
Okay.
And that may be something to look at a little bit. The next couple of pages deal with something called debt service revenue, and that's our major way of building buildings. We're going to talk about all these little programs, but really the vast majority of school construction projects are funded through the debt service program, and that's where school districts issue general obligation bonds to build a building or remodel a building, and then they pay that off with what we refer to as debt service. They repay the bonds by making an annual levy, and we've got a printout in the packet that talks about that and a couple of charts there. Why don't we turn to those? And Greg's going to talk about those charts for you. If you go to that set of charts, that's the annual school district debt service.
If you look at this one first, and look on the top, it's basically full debt service. So this is the annual payments districts are making on their outstanding debt, not the amount of outstanding debt. So you can see that going back 10 years or so, we've doubled, more than doubled the amount of debt payments the districts are making. From about $300 million to over $700 million we're projecting for 2009. So between this year, or last year, 2007, it's basically doubled, and then we're going to have another $100 million in the next couple of years. The light gray bar is how much districts are levying on their own to make those debt service payments. And then we have a program called Debt Service Equalization Aid that helps, it's designed to help districts pay those levies with state aid if they have low property values and high debt loads. And that's the black part at the top. And you can see that's been a pretty small portion of the annual payments. And the next chart actually gives you a better sense. The data is actually on the back of the page, but then the graph is gives you a sense of what's been actually happening with the state aid. Back when it was instituted, the bank's been the first year. But this, going back to 97, you can see it's about 11% of the total payments during that year and that we're projecting it'll be under 2% by 2009. And that's just because property values have gone up and the equalizing factors in that program haven't changed, with the exception, and you see that in 2003 and 4. In the 2002 session, we increased the equalizing factors for debt service and added the second tier. And I think Tim's got an example that maybe we'll walk through or just look at, but basically we created a second tier for districts with higher debt loads, with more debt, that has a higher equalizing factor, and so that added some state aid back in, but it took less, 2 years to get actually back down and below the 5.5% we were at before those changes were made. So with the exception of that little jump, we're seeing a pretty rapid reduction in the amount of state aid that goes into that program, and we're within a couple of years of it, of the equalizing factor being so low that no one gets any state aid out of the program.
Mm-hmm. Explain again the impact the property values have on this.
Sure, when we
clarify that.
If we just, we won't look at it specifically, but just when we have an equalizing factor, we calculate those equalizing, or the, we calculate the property value in mm-hmm. a district based on a per student basis. So we calculate the net tax capacity in the mm-hmm. district per pupil. And then we set an equalizing factor. And the equalizing factor is expressed as a dollar amount per pupil. There's a dollar amount, but then we compare that with the district's property value mm-hmm. per pupil. So in the case of debt service, say you're a low value district, mm-hmm. And you might get $4,000 per pupil of property value. Well, the equalizing factor for the first year of debt is $3,200. So if you're above that equalizing factor, you don't get any state aid. Mm-hmm. Then for the second tier, the equalizing factor is $8,000. So that the way we calculate the state aid, state share, is you just divide your value by the equalizing factor. So 4,000 divided by 8,000 is 50%. So that means that that amount, that second tier, you're going to get half of your payments paid by the state, and we get the levy for the other half. Mm-hmm. Well, property values have been going up so fast that the average, is the average $7,000 per kid of value, and that second tier at $8,000, you know, basically the average is going to be above that. So most districts aren't going to qualify, and that's with a higher level of debt. So really, it ends up with most districts not qualifying for aid because those equalizing factors are low. And one of the things that's kind of been talked about over the last few years is indexing equalizing factors. That is, we would instead of an initial equalizing factor. Now, say you redid it this year and said, okay, let's set it at $7,000 and get rid of all the tiers. So let's set it at $7,000 and then we're going to index it. And what happens then is you index it to relative to the, basically to the growth in property value in the course of a year. So if you set it at $7,000 and, you know, half the districts are getting, that's the average, so most districts are getting something, some a lot, whatever. But then property values grow by 10%, say. Well, that equalizing factor would grow by 10%, so that an average district will end up in relatively the same position. Otherwise, if what's happened in, over time is that property values have grown, you know, 5 or 10% a year, or whatever it is, and the district kind of loses ground relative to the equalizing factor, and so basically they kind of fall off the formula. They lose all their state aid, and they end up having to levy for the full amount of their debt.
So from 97 until now, when we the state is giving out 10.6% down to 1.6, basically because the property value changes, it does not have anything really to do with the legislature no longer funding.
Right.
Well, to the degree that they have increased.
What it is those dollar amounts we forecast them. Mm-hmm. So the legislature could go in and choose to raise the equalizing factor, which would create more aid going out.
Yeah.
We fully fund what's needed under the given formula. The legislature hasn't said, let's cut debt service equalization aid, but every forecast has come in and said, well, we need a little bit less because property values have grown. So we need a little bit less, and the legislature said, okay, we'll fund what's needed out there. And a couple of times, I mean, there's always a bill every year to say, well, the reason we need less is because we haven't kept up with property value growth,
yeah.
But then that costs money. Because, you know, if it goes from 20 to 15 million because of property value growth, that $5 million and say, okay, well, let's keep pace with, let's raise the equalizing factor to get that 20 that we had last year to have that alpha. Well, that costs $5 million in terms of how we budget, because the forecast cost is 15. So even though, you know, even though you kind of think, well, let's just have the same amount every year, because the equalizing factors are fixed, you know, you lose that amount. Now, if you had indexing in place, it would, the forecast come in and say, okay, $20 million. Now, if we didn't adjust the equalizing factors, it'd be 15, but we've got this indexing in, so it's actually going to be 20 because we'll recalculate the equalizing factors. 20 would go into the forecast, and there wouldn't, the legislature wouldn't see the added cost of needing to appropriate an additional $5 million over what was forecasted. It would just show up in the budget, and, you know, for the most part, unless there's, you know, an issue or a need to cut budget for whatever reason, that would be generally just be appropriated for that program. It's not been a conscious decision to not fund the formula as much as it has been easy to not think about it, because it's part of the budget that's getting smaller and there's all these other things that need money.
Sure.
And let's not worry about that. We'll just leave it as it is. Well, as is means it's falling off the table.
And the other critical part of that is those dollars are essentially property tax relief money, and when the Education Committee gets their target, as a general rule, they're loath to want to spend that on property tax relief. They want to spend that on programming. They want to spend that on new money for schools, not just on property tax relief. So it falls a little between, even though jurisdictionally it's a program in the K-12 area, it falls sort of in between the tax committee and the K-12 committee, because the K-12 committee doesn't want to spend its money just on property tax relief. It wants to buy additional programming, additional services to students.
So just not indexing the factor, for example, is this part of the aggregate of more and more reliance on local property tax for general operating revenues for schools?
Well, this is just construction, but it mirrors what's happening in all of our other programs that are mixed of aid and levy.
Yeah. And the history of this, up until 1993, fiscal 93, essentially all building projects except for maximum effort ones, which we'll talk about separately, were funded locally. So there wasn't any assistance on the building front up until 1993. So in some ways, it's a bit of a recent creature. It's 15 years old as a program. But essentially what's happened is the legislature has not been found a way to link it to property value increases or some other way, sort of hold the state share constant in the program. So every year it costs the state a whole lot less to do this program, and more falls on the property tax.
Okay. I've got my little, I voted today. We've got these 99 school districts all seeking referendums. And my issue with all this is that I always assumed these kinds of funding requests at the local level were designed to take care of capital investment outlays or extras, these kinds of things. But it seems, and one of the reasons I got involved in all this is because it, ever since at least the year 2000, maybe before, the state has been allowing more and more and more of the base operating budgets of school districts to be based on local property tax rather than state aid.
Well, and remember what Tim said, though, that these have always, I mean, for the most part, buildings have always been done through voter approval. I mean, you're seeing.
But I'm kind of stepping ahead, I guess, in a way here. I don't have any problem with that, capital outlays and that.
I think that'll be one of the questions that your group's going to face. Do you want to still have, you know, at some point in time, do you want to still have elections for capital outlays? And correspondingly, and it may not happen in this working group, probably going to happen somewhere else, the discussion's going to come up this next session. Do you still want to have essentially a voter approval required for referendums? And if so, the renewal count as that? And should the 10-year time limit come into play? That's a discussion that's going to happen this next session outside of this working group, but it ties directly in, I think, to how one sees the building projects. And really part of that big picture question is are building projects the kind that should still be approved at voter approval? Is there a reason not to do it that way?
this past session, as you probably both remember, the K-12 bill had exceptions for Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Yeah.
Said you don't have to go to the voters for your building project. That continues a tradition of 20-some years, 25 years at least for them. But it's raised questions in other people's minds, particularly in those communities that have had trouble passing a building bond issue and need them. So it's a big question, this question, what people vote for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, the 99 is separate from these four
points. Yep.
So you kind of have, I mean, there are similar issues, but
yeah,
they're, you know, they're...
Yeah, I understand the differentiation.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a really good question to ask. It's one I think people can be looking at pretty hard this next year.
Greg, if you didn't have more to add on that, maybe if we turn to the printout just real quick, we don't want to get too much into the computational details unless you're real concerned about that. But if you go to the printout that says baseline debt service revenue, K-2008, and we tried to make these documents, these look a little bit different to find. This one's got gray headers, no grid lines on it, oriented landscape on the page. A couple numbers to sort of at the very top to set the relative magnitude for you. You can see that for this fall's estimate, the pay 08 estimate of where we thought we'd be, in terms of that total debt revenue, about $759 million. So a pretty sizable chunk of money. I think the overall school spending for that year is going to be about $8 billion, so a little less than an eighth of about 10% of it, I suppose, is going to be in the building debt area. And you can see that that's more heavily concentrated in the metro area than in the non-metro area, even though the pupil count for the two in the next column over, the adjusted weighted average daily membership, that's a pupil count number. You can see that number is almost exactly evenly divided between metro and non-metro, but yet the metro area, not surprisingly, has $445 million of annual debt payments this year estimated, and the non-metro about $313 million. In part, there's been a lot of building in the metro area, and including in the center cities. And if you look down, just to give you a couple of lines that stick out here, Minneapolis is the second district listed on the printout. You can see that fully $61 million of debt levies expected in Minneapolis this next year, so that district's a little below 10% of the total, and about a seventh of the metro area. And then you can look down a little further and see Anoka, District 11, has $23 million of debt levy. So just those two alone make up a pretty large share of that metro metro building need. These numbers, you can see in the aid column that we're only estimating about $8 million of aid. In the baseline ANTC aid, it says about in the middle of the page, $8 million of aid. Most of that aid goes to the non-metro districts. You can see even with that aid going, you can see the tax rate slightly higher in the metro than the non-metro. That's not because of the aid, but that's because of the total amount of revenue that's there. And then if you look to the third to last column, This will help as we look at some of these other printouts. If you look at the revenue per pupil, just under $800, $799 of debt revenue per pupil. $900 in the metro area is the average, and $660 in the non-metro area. And if you look up and down that list, you can see that there are a lot of districts with very little debt and a lot of districts with a large amount of debt. And that's a pattern that holds true, in part because buildings are cyclical, enrollment growth is cyclical, that you can see that it's a program that really affects some school districts and doesn't affect others. And this is one of the reasons why the debt equalization aid program has gotten out of whack, in part because not everybody's going to benefit, even if it's a common sense change. The benefits aren't going to fall equally because there's only a portion of the districts that have a fair amount of building debt. And just by way of contrast, we're not picking on any districts, but just to give you a relative sense of how these things go, if you turn to page 3, districts 273 and 276 are Edina and Minnetonka. They're about similarly sized. You can see that both of those districts have $990 in one case and $965 in the other $965 and $1,100 of debt per pupil. So they're toward the high end on the building front. Most
if you go down to West Tonka, for example, 277, you can see they haven't got anywhere near the burden or the tax rate burden. They only have a 2% tax rate or an only a 3.8. And that's really a function of when these districts have built their buildings and when they've gone for their major remodeling plans.
Edina did,
and so they're in the class of spending a lot. And then if you want to contrast this, if you turn to District 2580, we're pretty close to the end of the printout. That's on page 9, about halfway down the page. Here's an example of a property poor school district, relatively property poor school district that's had a recent building plan. You can see that they just barely qualify for any equalization aid anymore, even though a few years ago they qualified for a lot. Their tax rate at 28% is more than double the state average tax rate for building units, and their building revenue essentially per pupil, the amount they're raising from the taxpayers to repay those bonds is $1,800, so that's more than double. Now, East Central had a new building that went up a couple of years ago. They got some state assistance with the maximum effort program for that. But you can see other examples of districts like there that with the relatively smaller mid-sized schools in greater Minnesota, if they need to build a new school and they're serving less than 1,000 kids, that cost per kid is going to be relatively high. And so you can look through this list, but basically this is the workhorse of the programs that we have to finance capital construction. The vast majority of capital construction is funded through the building debt program. These are voter approved, except in the case of Minneapolis and St. Paul, and occasionally when the legislature authorizes a grant for a district, a capital bonding grant, in which case they may not be approved. And occasionally we've had some disaster bond buildings where there have been tornadoes or fires where those bonds have not been voter approved. But essentially, they're done through the sale of bonds. The bonds pay the contractors, and then the taxpayers make a levy each year to repay the bond. Usually, the bonds are a 20-year term that almost always they're refinanced, so they're not level over the course of the bond. So you don't get a handy-dandy schedule, usually like you do with a home mortgage, where it's $1,000 a month that you're going to pay for the next 30 years. Instead, it tends to jump around a lot. There are some various reasons why school districts don't have level bond schedules, but you'll find that they work them around their other building projects. Maybe that new project went online and they're still paying the last of the high school project. They've got 5 years left on that, so they'll only do a little bit of the new debt they need, and then they'll jump the level way up.
Does the levy then go up and down to respond to that?
Yes. Yeah, and districts try to be sensitive to their other needs with that, but you'll find that their debt levy can jump around a bit. Their bond schedules, like I say, they often refinance depending, but their bond schedules are often lumpy depending on when other projects come due. Okay. So in the Edina case, if Edina did their big remodeling project, what, 3-4 years ago, was it? They may have had one of their last elementary schools that was built, you know, still being paid off, and they may have had a few years with it relatively low. And now they're probably going to the maximum that they can, and then if they need to do more building in the future, they may refinance and stretch it out and do things slightly different to try and sort of minimize bump from year to year in that tax rate.
So when the voters approve a building project or a levy, that goes off when that building is paid off 20 years from that.
Yes.
But the actual levy will go up and down depending on how much interest they're paying on that particular bond at that time.
Yep. Yep, and they can, like I said, they can refinance those, and so some funny things happen there. But basically, they usually aren't on a flat schedule. They tend to be close to a flat schedule, but oftentimes they'll pay just interest for the first couple of years while some other things are happening, and then they'll start paying the principal down. In terms of those bond issues, the actual mechanism that happens is the voters usually don't approve, and this may be important as you look at these issues too. Usually voters are not approving a specific project at a specific site, even though that's what the voters think. You know, the district sells it as, we're going to do remodeling to Edina High School. That's what this money's going to be used for. Usually the district does that, but they are really, with the question you're asked on the bond issue is, you agree to sell $20 million of bonds. And so some school districts, I think it was out in Chaska a few years ago, they had talked about building a new elementary school. The voters approved it. Everybody thought they knew what was going to happen. They couldn't come to a deal on where the land was. that we're not going to build it there. We'll build it, you know, in a different community that's part of this district instead. Very controversial, but essentially the case law in Minnesota allows that to happen, because what the voters are really approving is if you want to sell bonds worth X for school facilities. So usually the use doesn't change. You know, it's not that the people will vote for money under the premise that they're going to remodel the high school and then have them build a basketball court in an elementary school. But often on the siting issues, that can be a bit of a problem. So something to keep in mind with this. What they're approving generally is the sale of the bonds, not a specific project at a specific site.
I go back to the equalization tax again. For 15 years approximately, we've had this program. Over that period of time, what kinds of districts or areas of the state, school districts have benefited? Have they benefited? What groups have benefited more?
Is it the ones with low property values?
Yeah, although the West low property value has changed dramatically over time. So in the early years of the program, District 196, Apple Valley, Rosemont, Eagan, was by far and away the biggest winner of state aid under the equalization program. So throughout the mid and even to the late 90s, because they were doing so much building and their values were relatively low at that point in time, they were
so many kids.
Yeah, and they had so many kids that they were by far and away pulling home the biggest chunks of that equalization aid. And in general, because of the relatively low equalizing factor in the formula, the Hennepin County districts were receiving very little aid, if any, from it. So most of the Hennepin County districts never received a dime of equalization aid, even back in the original creation of the program.
Now, the fact that there hasn't been indexing, has that changed the tendency?
Yes, it's made it so that even the moderately property-wealthy metro districts have fallen off the list. So there's only really a couple metro districts that get any equalization at all anymore. It used to be a handful. Now, some of that is districts like Rosemont have become Rosemont District 196.
And if you look on the spreadsheet in the middle, you can see that even though 60% of the total debt is in the metro area, only $2 million of the aid is going to the metro area. And if you look down, you can see that the bulk of that is going to Centennial and Farmington, which is on the second page.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the big is going to two school districts.
Yeah. The big winners of the debt equalization were what you call third ring suburbs in the early days of the program.
Okay.
And now some of the exurban area is winning, but it mainly tends to be the very low value rural districts now that are getting equalization aid. There just doesn't tend to be much left, even in that ring out the fourth round of suburbs.
And back to that, even Centennial, I had a question about that, and they're saying they're going to be off it completely within a year or two. So I would guess Farmington will be in the same position. They've got value of 5,000, and their value is going to be going up like crazy.
Well, when this program was first being debated and considered, was there discussion about having this program encouraging districts that had low property values overspending themselves on the basis that they were then planning to get state aid and this kind of thing? Or was it more, this is a way to help districts with low property values who really need to improve
Much more of the latter, and I think that the mood at the time was too. We can only afford to do at such a level right now, which was about average tax base or less. But I think the thinking behind the program was, if there'd been more money, they would have wanted everybody to be in on it. They would have wanted a pretty extensive equalization, so the state would have been helping all but the very highest property wealth districts, so that building rate, which is one of the biggest variations in school tax rate, that building rate would have been much, much narrower. There was some talk about the former. There was some talk that, we'll see, with the state contributing 30% or 40% or 50% of the project, districts are going to choose to overbuild. There was some talk about that. I don't think there's many examples of that happening. I think there's certainly some examples of bond issues passing based on the belief that they were getting a great deal, that the state was really helping them out, that may not otherwise have passed. But I think I'm not aware of people being able to point at a school facility and saying, look, here's the here's a facility for $20 million that was built, and now there aren't any kids here, and it's just sitting empty, and it's only 5 years old, and debt equalization is what led to that. I'm not aware of any examples of that.
And along those lines, when this was instituted, there was discussion of behavioral impact, and this is the only equalized levy where there's actually an initial portion that's unequalized, where it's up to the first 15% of total property value, they don't get any equalization. And I think part of that discussion was around, wasn't it to have some impact on the behavioral, you know, the idea that the state's going to pick up this whole thing. Well, first of all, we're going to make you pay part of it on your own. And then once you get beyond a certain threshold, then it'll be
And I think a lot of the rationale was, look, once you reach that 15 percentage points that you need to make the local bond payments, then the state's going to step in to help. But you're putting quite a bit of tax burden on your local taxpayers. You're doing a 15% rate first before the state does anything at all.
Okay.
But I think, you know, it's a good question. Should the equalization start somewhere different? Should it start at the first dollar, or should it only be for those that tax rate is really, really high? You know, those are good questions to ask. I would say I don't think it was anyone's intent when the program was created to sort of target it only for some districts, but the net result of not keeping up as values have grown over time is that it really now only affects the very low tax base districts mm-hmm. that have big building projects. And that's part of why it's hard to fix, because there's not much of a coalition there to fix it when it might be the right thing to do, but 250 districts get no tax relief out of it, and 70 districts get a little bit, and 10 districts get a lot of tax relief. That's a hard thing to justify when you can say, well, we ought to do tax relief that benefits everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a hard thing to undo, but I think from a theory point of view, most everybody would argue that the equalization ought to be a lot higher. And that would help narrow that gap in rates. And then if it were a lot higher, the question becomes, would it be stimulative to school spending? Would we have to worry about that? And so far, I think there's not much of an example where we can point to in Minnesota where that's happened, where people have built something because of the state assistance they otherwise wouldn't have built.
It certainly has come up, though, in the community discussions of whether or not to build a project.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I remember one where they were saying for every $1 we put in, the state is putting in 4 or 5. This is a no-brainer, and they voted for it.
Well, and now five or ten years later,
now the state is putting in practically nothing, and they're putting it all in because their values have gone up.
Right. And part of that's a sales issue, and would it have passed if people had been aware that the state share wasn't the guarantee and would fall as the lack of sort of state keeping up with with the change in values happen. Part of it is behaviorally, if you would have asked me 10 years ago, would the state allow this program to fall to the level where it's only paying 1% of the total cost, they would have said, oh no, that won't happen. So, it's a little bit cart and horse on that to try and figure out which way that went.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly, it did lead to some of those bond issues passing. I think Upsala is one we hear about all the time where that happened. It's not clear to me, though, that we've built schools that shouldn't have otherwise been built because of this program. I think the bigger issue about schools that shouldn't have been built has to do with where those rural communities decide to hook up with each other, how they do that, and the state has essentially said, we're staying out of that business. If you want to avoid the big city of Mora, you go ahead and go the other direction, Ogilvie. We're going to let you go, and you figure out which relations make sense, which pairings make sense, and the result of that is we haven't, since the round of school consolidation started in the 1990s, we have had more than 150 school districts consolidate. We have not had a whole lot of schools close. We've had maybe a couple dozen elementary schools close, but we really haven't had a lot of schools close. And so we do have a lot of vacant school space out there, but it's not the result of the equalization program. It's the result about school boards feeling the pressure not to abandon the community and not to close an elementary school in the community. There's additional pressure on that for the few communities that have done that lately. A couple of them have had charter schools open in the very same community where they closed the local elementary school. So there's a pretty large behavioral disincentive for school districts to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's certainly, and as we talk about deferred maintenance and some of these other things, that's certainly an area where we've got some problems that don't seem to have any good solutions. It's what to do with the surplus space in greater Minnesota and how to make those buildings more efficient or make the pupils being served in a more efficient environment. One last thing I'd add on this debt equalization program, if you look down the list, you'll see that, and if you go back to this other list, the bond issue list too, Elk River, for example, is having an election today for $132 million of bonds to be sold all at one time. This is a lumpy deal. These bond issues are a lumpy deal, and school enrollment, just as Edina had to build that second high school, that didn't get used very long. It's very hard to know. There aren't good predictions about is Elk River going to need all this space? Are they going to continue growing at the rate they've grown in the last 10 years? I think it's very hard for the state legislature to second guess the locals on that, and it's very hard for the locals to really know if they're going to need all that space or not. But this is a common kind of occurrence on these bond elections where you'll see a district that already has Elk River is District 728. They're on the top of page 7. You can see that they've got 12,000 kids. They've got a couple thousand more kids than St. Cloud, which is 5 or 6 districts further down on the page. But you can see that in Elk River, their current bond payment's already $17 million a year, and now they're asking for an additional $132 million, of which, you know, is probably going to be somewhere between $7, $8, $9 million more that's going to go on that annual debt service levy on a per year basis. So they're going to be up in the mid 20s compared to a similarly sized district like St. Cloud, which is at the $3 million mark on their annual building needs. But then if you go down to the bottom of the page, another couple of fast growing districts, South Washington County particularly. 18,000 kids in the South Washington District, or District 833, you can see they've got $17 million of building debt there. I don't think they have a bond issue up this fall, but they do have an operating referendum up, but they just passed a real big bond issue last November, I guess. And that's probably not all on their debt load here. So my guess is when we see this number next year, the $17 million for South Washington County will be more like $20 million.
But this is what we've seen. I mean, if you go back over the last 50 years, whatever communities are growing rapidly, this is the kind of numbers they've had.
Yep.
And so this isn't unusual.
Not at all. And it's a question, I think in part of it gets to be a question, and do you need to do something special for the Elk Rivers and South Washington County for that? State, or do you just basically tell them, well, ride it out, just as Roseville and Edina rode it out and built a second high school in the 60s that turned out not to be needed for many more years? Or do you say, well, gee, is this, you know, do we really need this or not? And it's very hard to know.
And if they're building a school that, assuming they're going to have 10% growth for the next 10 years, and so eventually we'll fill this school, that's one thing, whereas if they're saying we've got 12,000 students now, we only have room for 10, we need to build to take care of those other 2,000 or 3,000 students. That's a little different scenario.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in the Elk River case, the other thing you have going on in a community like Elk River is that you have a district that consists of three very different communities. You have Elk River School District actually has chunks of 5 counties. It's mainly in 2, but it's actually covered parts of 5 counties. Zimmerman is very different community than Elk River, and Rogers on the other side of the river, you know, right off 94, at Rogers and Otsego Township, or Otsego City now, are part of the Elk River School District as well. So you have a district that has discontinued, you know, sort of doesn't have a similarity of interest. What Rogers may want may be very different than what Elk River wants. They're different counties, their growth patterns are different. Zimmerman's different too, but if you look at this bond issue for District 728, you'll see for Elk River, number 23 on the, oh, it just says additional space. But they're building something in Zimmerman, they're building some new schools in Rogers, and they're doing some remodeling in Elk River. So part of the issue is if you're going to get a bond issue to pass in a community that like that, is you maybe sometimes need to do some work that people could say, well, maybe you didn't need to remodel the Elk River High School this year. But they're not going to vote yes to vote for a new school in Rogers and a new school in Zimmerman and nothing for the people in Elk River.
So they've got one thing. When people go to vote today, they vote on one thing, either 132 or nothing.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be that way, but that's the way they're asking in Elk River.
And so sometimes they can go, well, this have three different votes.
Yes.
And so two may go through and one may not.
Yep. And that's up to the district when they put it on the ballot. They could run it as three separate questions. They could say for high school remodeling, for an elementary school in Community A, for a community center and community B. They could do it however they want. Elk River's got it all packaged together.
Mm-hmm. If you look down at 35 at Pine Island, mm-hmm. they've got a $30 million question to build a new high school. Well, then they also have another question to do repairs, and then on the KA building, and then finally the third question of, okay, do we want to do another $6 million on the high school with the gym and the mm-hmm. and the auditorium? And, mm-hmm. you know, they could have run that as a $40 million question.
I was going to ask about this question number two under Pine Island. My understanding is there was a time not too long ago when the state paid for things like roof repairs. Is that true?
Not really. The school district could use their general fund money for something like roof repair. So they may have had more flexibility before because there were less demands on their general fund. But it's not like they could let in the last. Since 1980, they couldn't levy for it separately unless they went to the voters. And if they take it out of their general fund, it's that same pocket pays for their instructional costs. Now there's a reserve in there called operating capital that you're probably aware of. That's about $200 per kid on average, mm-hmm. but that's generally nowhere near sufficient to do a major roof repair. So they really haven't had the authority to do that separately, but they may have felt that they've had enough excess money in their general fund to make those kinds of repairs out of it and to do some of that routine maintenance out of their general fund.
Well, the state never did.
No.
Nor did it ever provide for technology, this kind of thing?
There's been a series of technology grants over the last 10 or 15 years, but those have been relatively small amounts of money. You know, we're talking millions of dollars statewide as opposed to a program like this, which is hundreds of millions of dollars.
So over the last 6, 7, 8 years, there has not been an attempt in the part of the state to offload capital outlays and so on local school district referenda, that has really not essentially changed over time?
Hasn't really changed. I'd say what has changed is most districts will tell you their budgets are much tighter now, so if they used to have spare funds in their budget that they could do operating or do maintenance work, they can't do that anymore because they're using it to essentially pay for teachers and pay for regular programming, pay for the special ed costs that are unfunded.
But that wasn't because of state mandates to more differentiate the capital from the general operating?
No, prior to 1989, we had a very small amount of state assistance directly for capital funding that was part of the, that basically you could have a levy up to, at that point in time we used to talk about things in terms of mills. And you could have a levy of up to 9 mills, depending on your size, for a certain amount of dollars for capital. And the total dollar was limited, so it wasn't very much money. And in 1989, Representative Becky Kelso was leading a subgroup sort of similar to this, and they made some recommendations because a couple things were happening, and the federal government had just passed the Asbestos Removal Act, and there was a renewed interest at that point in time of the fire inspection, the health and safety inspection of the school district. So what was this one category of capital revenue, a fairly small amount, I think it was $25 per pupil, all levy up to 9 mills you could levy to get that $25 per pupil, was broken into three things. There was an equipment piece, a facilities piece, and then something separate called health and safety revenue. And what we're going to talk about health and safety revenue, but health and safety revenue allowed the district to do things like remove asbestos and make the safety changes the fire marshal requested. But for routine maintenance, it didn't help with that. The initial amount of facilities revenue was about $100 per kid, which was about four times greater than what it was prior to 1989. So that you know, in 1989, that was a pretty big change. That was a lot of money, $100 versus $25 that was there. And over the last 17 years, that amount basically hasn't changed. So it's still about $100 per kid there. So, you know, the time value of that money is a lot less now. But even still, that's been sort of flat at that level. We put a little addition on that gives you a little more or a little less depending on the age of your building. But that doesn't throw people off more than about $20 per kid one way or the other for the extreme. So basically, school districts are still getting, as a part of that operating capital money, that same $100. The equipment piece was run into it, so now they're all part of the same piece. I think one thing the school district would tell you is that their technology needs has meant that they use that 100, that the 70 for equipment plus the 100 for the facilities. That's now one pile of money that they're using that primarily for technology now, because they have technology needs. And in 1989, they weren't buying microcomputers with it. They weren't wiring schools with it, because those just weren't things they were doing then. But it may be that that's the money that, some folks are thinking about, but really it's not like there was any pot there that they could use for roof repair before.
And the history of all this, going back, I don't know how long, has always been that the state has had this differentiation between capital budget and operating budget.
Yeah.
And what's the rationale for that?
Well, the rationale is twofold, I think, on the debt side. One, you want to be able to promise the holders of the bonds that you're going to be able to repay that money. And so if it's in a separate fund and they know that the revenue that comes into that fund can only be used to repay those bonds, they're happier. So that's part of it. But part of it is it's also a good, I think, a relatively good accounting practice that money for facilities ought to be kept separate. Now, one thing that happened in the mid-90s is this capital money that I was talking about was added to the general ed formula and rolled into the general fund. So this $200 per kid of operating capital money actually is in the general fund, even though it's reserved for capital purposes. And there were eight funds at that point in time. The capital fund was one of those eight. The debt fund was a separate non-operating fund that was next to the capital fund. That capital fund got eliminated, and those amounts got rolled into the general fund in a reserved account that can only be spent for capital purposes. I think that was bad form for the legislature to do that. It blurred those concepts. But part of that is this whole equipment continuum is a pretty hard, you know, that's made it a hard thing to deal with. Before, a desk was pretty clear that was non-instructional. Textbooks could come from either the general fund or the capital account. They were a little less on the line, but now with instructional technology, is the computer a capital purchase? Well, how about the software? How about the wiring that hooks that up to the internet? How about the training that's necessary for that? And it all sort of gets run together. So I can see some reasons why we did it, but I think we would have been better off to keep the capital account entirely separate. I think buildings would be in better condition today if that capital fund were separate.
The reason I mention that is, you know, for an average taxpayer, for example, Hopkins district is one of my districts, they invested a lot in rebuilding and upgrading the high school. It's the Shangri-La, people are calling it. So one of the things they did was they built a very nice performing arts theater. But then because of budgetary problems on the operating budget, they had to lay off the teachers who would have been using the theater, so they had a nice theater set empty.
Yeah. Yep.
Now for taxpayers and people who are saying, how can the district build all this huge building and all this, and then at the same time they're laying off teachers and increasing class size. This makes no sense, and it leads to a real critical problem for somebody like me, who is then pushing for more funding for the school.
Yep.
They're saying, you know, why should I support this bond issue? I mean, they just put I don't know how many million into the Hopkins High School.
Yeah.
And now they're laying off these teachers, and I've got 45 kids in my. Yeah,
and they closed the favorite elementary school besides at the same time that they were doing building work elsewhere. Yeah.
Now, you know, I don't know. That's one of the reasons I wanted to come here. I'm just curious if there are any scenarios out there in which that kind of a situation can be mitigated by reworking this in some way.
And I think the short answer is no, and you don't want to do that on the school finance formula. You really don't want to undo that. Now, maybe you want the state to be more involved in that decision about whether Hopkins should have built that theater or not, you know, through the review and comment process. But once they've sort of physically committed to do something, and once the voters have authorized the sale of a bond, I don't think that there's a reason why you'd want to say, okay, well, you know, only build half of what you were going to, even though you told the voters you were going to do that, and use the rest for operating purposes. I don't think you want to go down that path at all. And I think it really is an example where maybe I do think that was a local problem, you know, the Hopkins, and maybe it was a problem brought on by choices that the state made about not sufficiently funding schools at the operating level, but I think the solution to undo that would be much worse if the state tried to step in and say, well, okay, in this case, we'll let you use that money however you want. We know you've got halfway through building the theater. Yeah. Take the other $10 million and just use that for operating purposes and don't finish the theater or you know, or something like that. I just don't think you want to do that.
Well, I remember talking to the board members, and I said, well, I understand you have the, you know, the opportunity here to put in this infrastructure, and I can certainly see why. But you're going to have an enormous problem down the road because the voters are never going to understand this.
Yeah.
And they're going to become very resentful. And then when you're asking for operating levies, which I don't believe school districts should have to ask for in the first place, I think that's the role of the state, you know. And I understand the state used to provide about 80% of that base formula. I don't know what it is now, but
yeah,
well, we're a little off the topic here, but I mean, it's,
this
system is causing
But I think the other part of it that causes the problem is a local government needs to be very careful if they decide they should build something that, you know, even if it's got a lot of great uses, if they're going to build something that people can point to say that that's the elementary orchestra room, or that's the theater at the high school that's nicer than all of the theaters in the rest of Hennepin County, or that's the sports complex connected to the Farmington schools that's going to have 3 ice sheets and 17 pools and who knows what else, that school boards need to be very cautious with that because people will remember those decisions even if they vote yes, you know, even if it prevails, people are going to remember those decisions for all of the future funding decisions that the school asked for.
Yeah.
They're going to say, well, they don't need my money because they had so much money they could build a theater. Even though that debt account, that capital account, totally separate, can't move money back and forth out of it, They're going to say, well, they built that fantastic headquarters building, or they built that great big bus garage that they didn't need.
Yeah.
Those decisions, I you know, you'll
there's no way out of that.
There is, if you want the state to be involved on the front end and say, you know, you can't build theaters, but I think, you know, probably better to say, well, no, if the locals make a silly decision, that's going to be their problem, as opposed to having the Commissioner of Education saying, well, you know, this theater is more expensive than all the other theater projects we've seen. We're not going to let you do that.
Are you going to be able to actually honor the staff?
Yeah. And there may be some benefit on that end if you wanted to think about beefing up the department's role in reviewing projects or sort of preventing boards from doing themselves in. But the other side of that is that may, you know, a very political governor might use that process in a very negative way. So,
I want the local district to make all the decisions they possibly can.
Well, and I think that's
like chafed under the Department of Education, Mr. Rail, about how it'd be so nice to just get rid of them all.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's where I'm coming from. But,
but
this is a, you know, like, and I'm going to try this out, but Hopkins, when they were remodeling, somebody gave them this wonderful fireplace. Free. I don't know how much it cost, so it's sitting now in, you know, this cafeteria. And I can't tell you the number of people who have a door knocking and saying, oh yeah, well, you're for education. Why don't you tell them not to spend $1 million on building a fireplace in the student cafeteria?
Yeah.
And then I would say, well, it was given to them. They didn't know what to do with it, so they put it in. Well, that's just crazy. I mean, it's really hard to go out and campaign for more money for kids.
That's right. I'll have to call it a biofuel converter. but that is a real question when you get to the issue of, but the alternatives, I think, generally speaking, people are going to say, well, state control is worse. We don't want the state to say you can't build a fireplace, or you can't build a theater, or you can't build a large swimming pool, if that's what the locals want to do. But school boards need to be very cognizant that when they're doing that, they open themselves wide up for criticism on living like kings.
The money that the state puts into the capital accounts, that has never been used or designated or designed to take care of capital building projects.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the basic thinking is if you need to do a big project, the bond issue the local property tax with some state assistance is what you're going to repay it with.
So they can do bigger projects, though, than what their annual inflow of operating capital revenue is. I mean, if they're $100,000 a year operating capital revenue district, and they've got a $500,000 project, they can do that. And does that take voter approval?
No, they can sell a short-term bond. They can do a five-year bond, basically.
Commit their revenue stream to pay the bond. So if they had to do a roof and they couldn't get it passed and they just had to do it, they could go that route.
Okay. Can money flow from the general operating fund into the capital expenditures?
Yes.
It can't go one way, but it can go the other.
Yes. Basically, you can't put it in the debt fund. So you can't use it to repay the bonds unless you get special approval from the legislature. But you can decide you're going to buy all your equipment and pay for a roof repair out of your general fund.
Right.
And if you had enough, you could even say, we're going to build a new school with it. Nobody would have that kind of money, but if you had $15 extra million dollars lying around in your general fund, you could say, yeah, we'll add an addition on it.
So with the capital account where it's currently at, however many dollars it is per student, are we typically seeing schools where that is significantly short so that they are subsidizing that with general revenue dollars, or it's approximately where it should be?
Well, I think it's actually going the other way. The districts feel the pressure to take money out of that account, and they classify every equipment expense that they can, they try and take out of that capital account. So, anything that they can get into that list, they try to move the other way, and you'll see, just like last year where you saw about 10 fund transfer bills to move money out of that capital account. You'll see half a dozen or 10 of those this year where districts say, oh, our facilities are fine. We just need that money in our operating.
So they have the facility slide a little bit to put the money into the classroom instead.
Are there areas floating around because of technological changes and so that it is within the realm of reason that districts could shift some more of these general operating funds into the capital?
Well, maybe. I mean, I don't see much pressure to do that, and they can do that on their own. They could just say we're going to buy $1 million worth of computers out of our regular general fund money that we'd otherwise pay for teachers with. They can do that right now. And I think we don't see that happening too much.
Can they do it the other way?
So can they take $1 million out of the equipment and the capital account?
Yes.
They can pay for certain...
How far can they go on that? Well, can you go to textbooks and stuff?
Yeah. Yes.
Operating?
Yes.
Right.
Computers?
You want to grab the... In volume
4, you can see that whole list.
There's an actual list of what things are approved for expenditure under operating capital, and it actually does include some things that you might think are strictly operating, like on the computer side, you can use it for support staff.
Okay.
No,
for actual software, but for the support staff.
Are there any other innovative facilities?
Well, and this is a good question to ask if we ought to have that money reserved at all now that it's been, should it be more flexible or not. The decision when Becky Kelso was around in 1989 was we need to reserve it to try and keep the building.
So there with acquiring land
was to go the other way, was to say, hey, we really need to worry about the physical condition of these facilities, and we got to make that money reserved for that.
Well, that brings up a question when we look at this chart and you see how much that has happened. Is that because we have not been spending the money we need to maintain facilities? I don't think it is. But
remember, a lot of this is maintenance. It's not just construction.
A lot of this.
Because the districts will go out and instead of doing a little bit each year with their operating capital, they'll go out and say, okay, we need $10 million because we've got roofs, we've got air handling, we've got portable, whatever it is they need to fix up, and they'll do it all at once, go to the voters and get approval for that. So
all the people who maintain the computers who run the system, all that kind of stuff. They're located in the district office or a site location. All that all can come out of the capital.
Yep.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
Which, you know, what you're saying then is that we, the schools have found enough things that they can spend that capital out their money on, so that they don't have the money they need to fix the roofs and the windows and those types of things. And then they let that build up, like you say, and then they go and say, well, look, the roof is falling apart. Whereas if they would have had the money they needed to, or this had been more restricted, then they would have had the money to fix those.
So yeah, and that's where the operating budget side pressure comes in, because if they would have had all those staff people in their general fund, and then they would have had, you know, say they've got 10 of those people, you know, that's $500,000 that they would have had in their operating capital fund for facilities. Well, if they're short $500,000 in the general fund because they haven't gotten, you know, the increases that they hoped for, then they might take that capital money, pay for those people, and then say, okay, we don't have money to do repairs now.
Yep. So managing the students.
So there is an interplay in that sense.
Yeah.
Could that be conflict?
Potentially, as long as they're, you know, as long as they're doing that particular task. So, and you can see that those things that are tacked onto the end have been added by legislatures in the past 6-7 years. Those uses get longer.
So there is a little breakdown on this.
Yeah.
Isn't there?
Yep.
Play.
Yep. Well, if you're ready to move on, I think it might be helpful. We'll skip over the rest of the debt calculations. If you guys want to get into the detail of how that formula works, we can you know, show you some spreadsheets on how the aid levy change would vary depending on what changes we make to the formula. That page there on page what's claimed to be page 40 of the handout. That shows how that calculation is made, but Greg and I could actually, it's kind of easier to work with a little spreadsheet, you know, and sit down with you and show you if you up the tax base, this is what happens. If you change the equalizing factor, this is what happens. So we can work through those with you. I think the other thing we'll skip over today, let me pass out a list on this, but I think for purposes of time, and this is going to be an issue we'll have to address, because there's going to be a request on the maximum effort front. This is a list of school districts that have maximum effort loans. The list is a year out of date. I was hoping to have a more up-to-date one for you today, but I don't yet. But this shows the districts that have gotten these maximum effort loans. These are where districts come into the state, use state bond proceeds, request the state to give them state bond proceeds to help build the cost of a new school. You look further down on the list, the East Central School, they had water damage, significant water damage to their relatively new school a few years ago, and so they had to build an all-new school. Other than Red Lake, they were the most recent district to get a maximum effort loan. Essentially, the state gave them about $18 million as the state contribution. The locals are still paying a very high tax rate of 28% to make the local share on that project. But these are all the districts that have benefited from that maximum effort program. If you look at the bottom of the list, the very first district to get one was the Fridley School District. And if you look up from the bottom of the list, you can see a lot of fast-growing suburban districts were the ones that got them in the 60s. That was sort of who the program was designed for. Then, starting in about 1980, almost all the districts to get them have been rural, with the exception of Farmington and Lakeview. And the idea, essentially what's happened there is the fast-growing metropolitan districts in the early years of the program, they were adding so many kids. They were kind of in an Elk River type situation. They were adding so many kids and they had so little tax base that they just weren't able to build the schools they needed. So the state made these loans to them. Most of those loans in the early years were paid off. If you look from 1981 forward, you're going to see that most of the loans aren't ever going to be paid off. The maximum effort loan program, they're forgivable loans. For districts that got loans before about 1993, I think, or 1991, they were 30-year loans, and then after that, they were 50-year loans. So East Central, the tax roll, the taxpayers in East Central are going to work on paying off that $18 million loan over the course of the next 50 years. They'll probably never pay it off, given the relative tax base in the community, and at the end of that 50-year time, the state will forgive the outstanding balance on that. Same with the other districts towards the top of the list there. But we'll, I think we'll spend separate time on the maximum effort program.
And we can do that an hour later, but I want you to explain it exactly the difference between this and the regular
So on the maximum effort program, what happens there is prior to 1993, we didn't have debt equalization. So if you didn't have any tax base, you weren't able to build a new school. Because you couldn't tell your taxpayers, well, you know, we'll hit you with a 100% tax rate, it just wouldn't have sold. So in order to help the really low value districts, the state would use bond proceeds, money from the state. The state would sell bonds, essentially, and then they'd make a loan to school districts to help build the building. The school district would pay for some of the costs locally, and then they'd have this loan from the state, and as their value grew over time and their need for growth slowed down over time, they could start repaying the loan to the state. So, for example, a district like, let's go up to, where's a good one of a district paying off a loan that they got one relatively recently? Let's see here. Well, if you go to Dover, Iota, District 533, which is about 10 or 12 down on the list, you can see that they got a $3.7 million loan from the state in 1992 to help build a new school, and then they paid that off. Their value, they're right near Rochester, their value grew enough over time that they were able to raise enough money to pay that off.
And just mention how it's called a maximum effort school loan program because the amount that the district has to pay or has to raise is specified by a tax rate in law, and that it's right. Is it 32% now for 28 or 28%? So 28%, and that was lower prior to 2007.
Yeah.
So basically, we tell the district you have to levy 28%. And so that's why when you look down the printout, you see a lot of 28% on that levy. But and then after they make their whatever payments they have to make locally, they send the balance of whatever that 28% raise to the state to pay down their maximum effort loan.
So when they pay off their share of the building loan,
yeah.
So if it was a $12 million project, Ogilvy, for example, here, they've got $11,300,000. If it was a $12 million project, they borrowed $700,000.
Yes.
They make their payment out of the 28%, and the rest of that money goes
right
to the state.
So if that 28% was $100,000, and their payment was $80,000 a year, then they'd send that 20 to the state. Some districts don't have anything left. And so their balance to the state just grows. But then in the case of Dover or some of those, like Farmington, or some of those districts where the tax base is growing because they're developing, then that 28% raises more and more every year. Because, you know, first year it might raise $100,000, and then, you know, as it grows in 10 years, it might be raising $300,000. Well, if their local share has stayed relatively flat, then they're sending more and more into the state every year, and that's where the districts that we expect will pay off these loans are, is the districts that have growing tax base.
Right. Now, when Ogilvy started this in 1990, was it 15% at that point?
Yeah, somewhere around there, yeah.
And I think then they went to 22 and then 28?
22 and then to, I think, 24 and then to 32 and then back to 28.
Yeah, okay, so they
and
did come
those back. Those have been confusing adjustments that have come from two different ways. Some legislators about 10 years ago didn't like the maximum effort program. They wanted to stop making maximum effort loans. They thought districts got too good of a deal, and they pushed up the maximum effort loan repayment rate to try and essentially be tighter fiscally at the state level about those loans.
And it was tied in with that one expansion of the debt service program that we talked about, basically to try and incent them out of maximum effort and into going to their voters and doing a regular bond issue.
Okay. Yeah. But then the second thing that happened is tax base. We've had some major changes in tax base over time, and we made an adjustment for the 2001 changes in tax base. that pushed the rate up to 32%, and it really should have been more like 28% to be the equivalent rate. But we took a bunch of property tax and lowered the value on a predominantly commercial industrial property.
Okay.
And so that rate change, you know, so it's hard to compare the 15% rate to the 28% rate. We know it's higher, but it's not really against the same
figure.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because that's one of the things that I hear about when I'm out in the Overby area is, you know, when we negotiated this deal with the state, they said 15%, and all of a sudden they're taking, you know, 28 and I've heard as high as 32.
Yeah.
Well, they get to change the rules after, you know, we cut the deal, and they, of course, didn't like that.
Right. And a small point, this is apropos of this and other things in the school area that you should probably be aware of as legislators, you're essentially Gumby. You can tell the school district what to do. In Minnesota, they don't have constitutional protection. They're not a constitutionally created thing. If you tell them to do more of something or less of something, you can tell them to do that. So it may not be fair, it may not be right, but in terms of sort of an argument, they don't have essentially a standing in which they can say, hey, we're something that can't have these things retroactively changed on us. You can go ahead and change those things on them. You know, obviously you wouldn't want to do that to Ogilvy, but they don't have a right to say, well, you can't do that, because essentially they're essentially an arm of the state for almost all purposes in Minnesota.
Now, several of these schools on here passed what's called a one-day levy.
Yes.
One-day bond.
Yep.
Explain that to me, please.
Yep, and if you look at this other sheet, you'll see that there are a couple of districts that are doing that, too. The way, as Greg was saying, the way that maximum, and let's just look at, where's one?
Central is on
there. Right up in the
Laporte. Laporte, okay, there's, if you look on number 13, Laporte, they're doing a one-day bond sale. They already did that on October 9th. And that passed. The way the maximum effort program works is we determine how much the bonds they need to issue locally, then the state basically gives them the rest of the bonds that they need to build that facility, and then we tell them levy the maximum effort, the rate of 28% to repay those bonds. So they're levying the 28% to repay those bonds. In Ogilvy's case, that's enough to essentially make the local payment. Now they've got $495,000 left over.
Laporte.
They've got $495,000 left over. If they didn't have this one-day bond sale, they pay their loan back to the state. They pay $495,000 of the loan back to the state. And instead, Laporte is saying, hey, wait a minute. If our voters go approve a one-day bond sale of $495,000, we'll take that $495,000 that we were going to send to the state, and we'll do that with roof repairs. We'll spend that on something like roof repairs.
So what they're doing is they're selling a bond. That 28% raised that $495,000. So they can say to their voters, your taxes aren't going to go up. They sell the bond one day, because they sell the bond, and the next day they can pay it off with the $495,000 they've already levied against their voters. And all that's happened is that the state is out the $495,000. The voters pay the same 28%. Their levy doesn't go up, and the school district gets another $495,000 to spend.
Spend on capital.
And if you look,
does it follow the same capital rules as what we just looked at?
They can do that for a capital project. Can't use it for operating, but
okay, so it's not the same lift. It's actually the whatever debt.
If anything, you could basically physically buy. I mean, you'd have to be able to buy.
It's not like the staff and the.
They can redo their parking lot every year. They can build a new gym or put on new roofs or buy a computer.
Yeah, but if you look down the list, if you look at Onania, another capital loan district, number 33 on that list, they're going to restore their track and field facilities for $360,000. Now, in Laporte's case, interestingly enough, if you look at the loan balance on that capital maximum effort loan balance summary, you can see they're actually paying off their loan because they've got enough value in Laporte that they're paying off their loan, whereas in Onania, which is very poor, as you know, they're not going to be able to pay theirs off. And why am I not seeing them on the list here?
I don't see them either.
13?
Oh, this one.
Maybe they don't, but I thought they did.
But the interesting thing, I mean, the thing about like a Laporte is that
your Roseville's got almost a $500,000 bond, and they're going backwards every year.
Yes.
And the thing about LaPorte is they've paid off almost half their balance, so it isn't clear whether they're raising more than the $495,000, and so some they're still making payments to the state, or this is just the first year they've figured out that they can do one-day bonding.
And this is a controversial part of it. You know, you got, it's part of whether you treat a maximum effort as something other than a loan. 10 years ago, people were really mad about these one-day bond sales. Now they're less mad about it. They're sort of saying, well, those guys have no other way to do their routine maintenance. They're already levying 28%.
And they're not going to get, they don't have enough tax base to get a, and well, with an election.
Yeah, what I think we've seen happen in some of these schools, they fix things and make
them. Well, that could well be. That could very well be. And that's one of the concerns about this is, and again, it creates an inequity if some districts can do these one-day bond sales, and the district next to them is just as poor and never got a new building through the maximum effort program, and they can't do a thing. Then the one that's doing its track and field repairs, and the other one doesn't even have a new high school, much less a track. A very inequitable way to do things. So,
and I was talking to one of the superintendents who isn't there anymore on this list, and he basically says, "We've got $400,000 a year. We've got to find a place to send it."
Yeah.
Yeah. If we don't spend it, we send it to the state. So guess what? We find a place every year to spend it.
Right. Which is and another argument against why, if that maximum effort rate were lowered some, they'd raise less in total, and it wouldn't be a as big of a problem in some cases.
Would it be appropriate, or should we consider looking at something where, you know, if you pass a one-day levy, then instead of 28%, we'll make it 24%?
Well, you could think about that. I think you should think about the one-day sales, and maybe you want some stricter evaluation of whether those are necessary or not. But it is, you know, one of the things that Mindy always harps on is she wants a fair system. She doesn't want disequalizing resources. This has the effect of being a disequalizing resource, because some districts can do it and others can't.
And when the maximum effort program was designed, as Tim said, there are some growing districts in there. I mean, I think that if it was intended as a loan program, and that any excess above what the district has to pay that maximum effort rate raised, it would go back and pay off that loan.
The way it currently is, I mean, the voters complain about it because now they're paying 28% instead of the 15% they originally negotiated with. And the superintendents are saying, well, you know, we've got this money, we got to find a place to spend it, and it doesn't always make sense to do that. And so they see the problem with it. And so I really think that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a part of the result of the rate being set too high. If that 28% were lowered some, for a number of those districts, if we're at 24 or 22% or back down to 20%, they wouldn't have any excess. Now, state wouldn't be getting paid back rent either, but they wouldn't be spending.
That's always the question of whether this is actually a loan program or a grant program.
Yeah.
Right.
And if you look at the term of that, you know, LaPorte is, fifth on that list or sixth on that list. They've got till 2051 to keep paying on that loan. So in some ways, it's less of a concern for us if they keep doing one-day bond sales. They've got a declining balance, and they've only got, their taxpayers are saddled with that for a number of years. Whereas in the Roseville case, that's not going to ever be paid off.
Right.
And it's, that amount when it comes time to forgive that loan, because the interest gets added to it each year, that's going to be $40 or $50 million the state forgives at that point in time.
Yeah, and I suspect that the kind of the most abusive practice of it would be a district that actually was growing and lowered its balance down to, $100,000 or $50,000, $500,000, and then had an excess of a couple $1 million or $1 million every year, and just said, we're going to keep that balance for the next 50 years so that we can levy every year that 28% rate and just keep the money.
And in some ways, those, they're not being entirely fair to their taxpayers if they're not telling them that if we repay the loan now, we're not going to owe as much 10 years from now. So it may be the case that now it doesn't make any difference if it's going back to the state. But 10 years from now, if they kept paying, they may have had that loan paid off.
Yeah, because you look at LaPorte, and they're 6 years into their loan, and their balance is half paid off, which implies that their tax base is going up so fast that they're probably under, within 10 years of paying it off. To continue to do one-year bonds in 10 years instead of having, 0% instead of 28%, they're still going to have a balance. They're going to still be doing that 28%. So, as Tim said, this is for the voter, it's a short term. They can short term say, look, we're not going to hit you for any more than you would have been hit with it otherwise. But, you know, in 5 or 10 years, you wouldn't be paying anything, and we're going to still have it on the books because we've done the Monday bond.
And one of the things to be careful with this is you're going to find that there are people that represent those districts are not going to be happy if they perceive the money as being spent on projects that they want to have done, and as superintendent they're losing that, you know, they're going to see that as an attack on them and their district. So it's a hard thing to inject good discipline into, and you know, part of this is a negative reaction to the reaction in the late 90s when the capital bonding committee in the House basically said, hey, we don't want any more maximum effort loans, we wanted to pay them all back. We're not going to help those communities. I mean, you sort of had, you know, entirely, you know, we're going to get you kind of message going out instead of, well, how can we really make this a fair program? So something to be concerned about. I think the only maximum effort request you'll get this year is for Red Lake. We can talk about that some more. There are other issues up there. But Red Lake has been building a series of projects to remodel their elementary and secondary schools, and a series of building projects. And do they have $51 million remaining to do, or some?
Their election is for $61 million.
For $61 million, so they've got a huge amount. You're going to see that request during session, but we'll need to talk more about that issue.
Okay. Did the legislature approve each of these?
Well, you don't have to, but you do now. The law didn't used to require you to, but now they have to be approved in law. So not only does the bonding money have to be approved, you actually have to put in a sentence that says the capital loan of X million is approved for District X.
Okay.
And that's a relatively new feature. It used to be that we just appropriate money out of the bond proceeds and then districts would apply. And then if you look on this list, you can see in the early 90s, there were just a ton of districts that applied. Mm-hmm. And the legislature didn't quite know what to do with all that. And the way those projects got administered by the department didn't make some people happy. So in 92 or 93, I forget which, the legislature said, okay, we're going to approve each one of these projects individually. We're not going to just have a pool of money out there and have the department administratively push that out. So we're about 3:30. I think maybe we should move on just a little, if you don't mind. If you go to page 44 of the packet, of the narrative packet, the Cooperative Facilities Grant Program is a program that was designed a number of years ago to help build what we're often referred to as the cornfield school, the cooperative secondary facilities. This last year, the legislature expanded that program, so it's not just for secondary facilities. You're going to see two or three requests under that program probably this next year. They want state bond money to help build local schools. Rushford Peterson, a group of schools out in Lincoln County, and Wells, the United South Central School District, are the three districts you're likely to see wanting state bond proceeds to help build a new school. And so this, and we can spend more time on this program later. If you look at the chart on page 45, the grant amounts that went out in the late 80s and early 90s were for about $6 million for most of them. The Lancaparo School got an $8 million grant. The grant limit has been upped now to $20 million, or 75% of the project cost, whichever is less. And I think you'll see at least two of those three schools asking more like the $20 million request of state bond proceeds. And as a committee, the Education Finance Committee is going to have a list of projects. Those are going to compete against higher ed buildings and bridge infrastructure and road infrastructure and other capital projects. So you as a committee will pass something over to the bonding committee, but you're likely to get a couple of requests for those. I think some of the questions you'll face with that are, does it make sense that just because they've consolidated, they should be able to get this? Should we look more carefully at how many students they're actually serving? Should we look at what their neighboring districts are doing on the building front? All of those questions are going to come up when we look at these facilities grants this year.
And these need to be approved one at a time.
Yeah, and then these, they don't have to, but these do not have to, but In the past, they've been approved one at a time. After the first round of grants were issued in 1988, they've all been named in statute. All of those other projects, the Minnewaska High School, the Blue Earth, Grant County, and the Atwater Cosmos and Grove City projects, all of those were named in statute.
When they've given a grant of $6 million, is that what it cost them to build, or that was just a part of the total cost?
It was part of the total cost, okay. And those schools were a lot less expensive than the relative, you know, even inflation-adjusted schools' costs have really, really skyrocketed. So I think the lack of Pearl Valley High School, I think that was a $15 million project in total to build an all-new high school.
Okay.
75% was different cost.
Yeah.
Okay. So the voters still had to approve a referendum for approximately half of the total cost.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we'll talk about that a little more too, but let's move on to health and safety revenue next, which is on the bottom of page 45 there. There's a printout that goes with this that's oriented portrait style, says health and safety revenue at the top of it. Now, in terms of context, remember on the bond issues, we're talking about $700 million per year. If you look in the middle column here, health and safety baseline revenue, you can see about $72 million of health and safety revenue. So about a tenth as much as we annually spend, about 10% as much as we annually spend on building debt. Health and safety revenue is to make health and safety changes to facilities. It's not for deferred maintenance, but it's for things like removing asbestos, taking the lead out of drinking fountains, removing fuel tanks, correcting fire marshal repairs, those kinds of deals. And if you look up and down that list, you can see the amounts on a per pupil basis particularly vary dramatically. These amounts tend to change year to year from school districts. School districts have a 3-year plan for their health and safety purposes, sort of a rotating plan over 3 years. So maybe take South St. Paul, or take McGregor, for example, district number 4. This last year, they had $230 per pupil in approved projects. This is one of the few formulas we have that's not pupil-driven. That is, we don't say you get $100 per kid or $50 per kid. We say, okay, anything that's an eligible project qualifies, regardless of what that is. And you can see McGregor and Hill City right next to each other as communities have roughly the same number of kids. Hill City only had $20 of projects per kid. McGregor had 230. In part, that's because the McGregor school is real old. Hill City got a new school not all that many years ago. So the health, and the other thing is health and safety varies by year. Maybe some years the school district's going to find it's got to make a decision to take out an old boiler that's got asbestos, or maybe it's got to make some fire marshal repairs, and then once they've made it, they don't need to use it again.
The school board can put that levy on without...
Yeah, without voter approval. So as long as it's for the, there's a long list in statute of the project. A bunch of those are listed on the bottom of page 45 here. It's things like removing or disposing of PCBs or asbestos, removing fuel oil and old tanks, eliminating fire safety hazards and life safety hazards, and correcting certain air quality problems. Although basically it doesn't allow you to install a new boiler or a new air handling system. It allows you to remove an old system that's not working right.
But it doesn't help put in the new one.
Right. Big source of controversy, and we'll talk about that a little more when we talk about the alternative facilities program. But basically, this program, you can see on the levy, which is just one column to the left of the revenue, the levy is almost the same as the revenue. There's just hardly any state aid left in this program. That's because, again, the equalizing factor for this program hasn't been changed since it was created in 1989. And so as a result, a program that used to be, if you look back on the chart on page 46 of the narrative, in 1998, there's $50 million of levy and $14 million of state aid. As you work up that chart, you can see that levy amount has grown and the aid amount has fallen. So mm-hmm. I see a typo on line, on the second line down there, the 732. Yeah, that's the typo. There's an extra digit in there. Crop out any one of those digits. You'll be fine. So health and safety basically is for these projects that the legislature says is anything on this list. Now, there's no reason you can't put deferred maintenance on the list. If you do, it's going to cost you a lot of money on the fiscal note, but the legislature has sort of made this decision that it doesn't include deferred maintenance, but it does include anything that's essentially a hazard.
I'm just going to point out, if you look at that graph, you see the chart between 04 and 05, there's a big drop-off. You see the levy is at 130 and the aid at 5, so about 135 million, and then drops down to 91 million. And during the, you see that?
No, what page are you on?
This health and safety chart. You can see that the combination in 04 and 05 of aid and levy is about 130.
Oh, okay, the combination. Okay.
Million, yeah. Okay. And then next year there's only $91 million worth of projects. And
right.
It's not because they fixed everything up and didn't have any needs. As part of the dealing with the budget issues, the legislature really restricted what could be included as health and safety projects, and also, and we'll get into this on alternative facilities, but also allowed districts with large health and safety projects, or required them to run those through the alternative facilities program. So,
what happened in 2002 to 2003? It's a big change there also.
Yeah, just a lot more need for youth. I think that some of the original air handling decisions came in that year. And this is an area where you get a lot of complaints from school districts to say, it's a crazy thing to say we can take out our old heating system that doesn't work and full of mold and can't have money to put in a new one.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, gee, you're making it a lot more expensive for us not to do it all at once. We can rip down a wall, pull out the mold, we can't build the new wall. And there's a lot of truth to that, but the reason for that is because you have to pay the cost of anything that they can do, and if you open the program back up, it has a big levy cost for you.
Yeah.
So, I think it's too bad as the budget saving measures. We made those changes in 2005. They complicated things a bit for you. They saved a bunch of money. On the other hand, if that would have come out of the operating account, if that would have been off the formula, probably would have been a worse deal. But nonetheless, it's created a system where you can do this and you can't do that. You can remove the panel, but you can't replace it. You can take out the mold, you can't put in the new floor once you've taken the moldy carpet off. You've got to find other funds to do that. So health and safety has been around since 1989. There's relatively little controversy about it other than this list of projects that can be done or can't be done. Seems to be working really very well, even though it's a variable amount of money for school districts. And you look up and down that list and you can see that some school districts hardly do any projects with it, others do a lot, and that will change from year to year as their facilities needs are identified. One of the really nice things about it is as other codes change, you don't have a fixed environment for the funding so that you can accommodate that. So let's say that the fire code has changed, and where they used to allow a certain kind of exit facility, they don't anymore. The district has to put in all new doors for that. That works out pretty well because you sort of automatically adjust underneath those code changes. Same for things like if there's a change in the standard for lead in drinking fountains or a change in the asbestos standard from the federal government. It allows them a lot of flexibility to respond to that. It all gets placed on the taxpayers. There's hardly any state aid left. But it really does give districts a good tool to respond to critical situations. I'd say one of the biggest problems you face with health and safety, other than this idea that you can't put in the new stuff to replace what you've taken out, is that there are some school districts, and this gets a little to the issue of who's going to get bonding money this year, there are some school districts that are facing very big fire marshal orders, not too many, but a few, who really need a new school or need not to have kids in that old school, and they're not. Their communities haven't been willing to make a consolidation decision or a new school decision, and the result is that I think you're going to see a handful of districts make a ton of health and safety improvements to really bad old buildings that 5 years from now there aren't going to be any kids in.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what the answer to that is. It's a tough situation, but I think there's at least a handful of those that you're going to face where they'll put $1 million into correcting some fire safety repairs in the building this year, and 2 years from now they're not going to be there.
Greg, anything you want to add on health and safety?
No.
Okay, so that at 70-some million, that's health and safety. The health and safety program led to us creating, the legislature creating the Alternative Facilities Program in the early 90s. And what was happening, the property tax situation was really critical in the early 90s, and the legislature was very worried about what was happening with the health and safety levy. And some years they capped the total amount of health and safety levy. And the big districts had a lot of projects to do, and they'd throw off whether a little district could get any money at all, or whether their money would be scaled back 20% or not. And in a program that emerged from the department that really had very unintended consequences, the department said, well, let's pull the big districts out of the health and safety program. And by the way, let's give them the authority to do deferred maintenance. And so we created a class of districts that has either, there's two categories that qualify. If you're either more than 1.85 million square feet of building space, and your buildings are on average 15 years old, or 1.5 million square feet of building space and your buildings are more than 35 years old, you get to do alternative facilities without going to the voter. And this program is called the Alternative Facilities Program, and you've got a spreadsheet that looks like this. Says alternative facilities revenue, it's got good lines on it, and it's oriented landscape. The bolded districts are the ones that qualify for the program, and the majority of those are grouped right at the top. There's some other districts run in, but don't worry about that too much. That first column of data shows the square feet in terms of building square feet. You need to be above that 1.5 million and 35 years of age to qualify. And you go down that list there for the bolded districts, and you can see who's qualifying. There were a couple of districts, Stillwater included, that were added legislatively without meeting the qualifying characteristics. But if you, White Bear and Stillwater were the two that were just by fiat added by the legislature a number of years ago. But you can see that these districts do a tremendous amount of deferred maintenance without having to go to the voters, because they fit this definition of being large. And you can look at those relative amounts. Then it's something that's even crazier to explain. The 1995 legislature was trying to do some things with the tax system, with the property tax system. And the tax committee had come up with a new plan for property taxes that had messed up the taxes in the center cities pretty substantially. And they weren't going to be able to pass it because the taxes in Minneapolis in particular were way too high. And so what the tax committee did is they said, well, hey, how about if we take over a bunch of the alternative facilities aid payments for school districts? So this is deferred maintenance that most districts can't do, but now even better, we're going to take some and put it on the state aid as a way of bringing down the overall tax rate in Minneapolis so we can get this tax plan passed. And what happened there is you can see on the first line of this printout, the Minneapolis School District gets $11 million in state aid a year under the Alternative Facilities Program. Then they levy another total of $12 million, so they get a total of $23 million in alternative facilities revenue each year to do deferred maintenance. Most districts can't do deferred maintenance, and in addition, $11 million of it from Minneapolis is coming with state aid. Now, this is a huge sore spot with this program. It's an absolute huge sore spot. This wasn't the creation of the Education Committee. This aid was created by the Tax Committee to basically allow them to make some compression of the commercial industrial tax rates, and they had to figure out how not to hurt Minneapolis as bad as they were hurting the tax rate in Minneapolis. And the method they came up with was giving them a bunch of state aid in the school funding formula for deferred maintenance for alternative facilities revenue. So what you have is a situation that's relatively unfair, because some districts now can do alternative facilities, they can do deferred maintenance without going to the voters, and others can't, based on the size. And if you look on the first page, for example, look down to District 276, the last bolded one on the first page. Mm-hmm. According to our current data now, Minnetonka is able now to do deferred maintenance without going to the voters. They don't have to go have a bond issue anymore to do deferred maintenance because they've got more than 1.5 million square feet and they're more than 35 years old, whereas if you go down four more lines to Edina, a similar community has about the similar building needs and debt needs.
They're slightly lower on the square footage. They have 1.3 million square feet, so they don't qualify. So now we're telling Minnetonka, go ahead and do deferred maintenance without going to your voters. Edina, if you want to do that, you're going to have to go to your taxpayers and ask your voters to approve it. So the alternative facilities program is probably the biggest thorn in the side of our formulas that we've got on the capital side. It's a tough thing to figure out how to undo, how to make better, but it's a real problem, and that state aid portion of it makes it a real problem too. But basically, the big districts, the super big districts in the state, can do deferred maintenance without going to the voters.
And what can they use that money for?
Anything that's deferred maintenance. They need to put in a new boiler, fine. They need to repair a roof, fine. They need to set point a building, put in new windows, they can go ahead and do that.
And they can use it for health and safety projects,
yes,
too.
Yeah, yep.
And then, and just the other thing I mentioned on health and safety is where you see, down below, you'll see scattered through the printout other districts that have alternative facilities levy, and that's from, in 2004, for 2005 or 2003 for 2005, when we mandated as part of that reduction on health and safety that districts that have projects above $500,000 run them through alternative facilities rather than through health and safety.
Yeah.
So you see some other districts,
but it's really health. The ones that aren't bolded, it's really health and safety they're doing. It's just a bigger project, and they were required to do it through this program.
So these aren't deferred maintenance projects.
They're not.
These are health and safety projects.
Yeah.
The only ones that are getting any state aid out of it are those right on the top.
Right. And yep. And even the levy, the only guys that can do deferred maintenance instead of health and safety are the ones that are in bold. The only thing you can't do with this money essentially is build new. So you can't do new construction with it. But you couldn't build a new building or add a classroom wing on. But you can remodel to your heart's content with it. And very sore subject. The end result of that, in 2 years ago or 3 years ago, the deferred maintenance program for other school districts passed. And that's described in, starting on page 47 of the narrative, at the bottom of page 47 there. Oh, and one other thing, if you look at that alternative facilities revenue chart, starting on the, just above that on page 47 in the narrative, so go to page 47 of the narrative and look at that chart there, and you can see that, you can see that in 1998 we only had $17 million in the alternative facility. Let's see,
go back one.
So look at the bottom of that chart first. You can see that this alternative facilities is growing really dramatically. Mm-hmm. The ones that do an annual levy, it's called pay as you go, is growing from $8 to $65 million in about 10 years, and the bonded debt portion is growing from $17 to $70 million. So these numbers, you know, the combined numbers of these are even bigger than the health and safety program put together. Now, granted, it's a lot of kids and it's a lot of facilities, but it's a few number of districts that get to use the alternative facilities program. Mm. So I think the 2000, I don't remember which year it was, 2005 or 2006 legislature said, okay, we really have to do something for the other districts. So we passed the deferred maintenance revenue program. And that program essentially says, okay, if you're not in the alternative facilities program, we're going to give you a maximum of $60 per kid for deferred maintenance purposes. That's going to come in a separate formula. And you've got a printout here, estimated FY 2009 deferred maintenance revenue program printout that shows how much money school districts are getting under that under that program, and that's weighted by the average age of the building. If your buildings are more than 35 years old, you're getting the whole $60 per kid. If they're newer than that, on average, you're going to get some number less than that. So, for example, go ahead.
On table 25, is that the total then for
yep.
the state?
So all the rest of the state's only getting about 27 million a year. For deferred maintenance, whereas the big districts are getting more than $100 million per year, and again, it was a small step to try and correct that. $60 per pupil is still a relatively large amount of money, but not compared to the thousands that's being spent in some of these large districts.
The appropriations of the state share.
Yes, and that's going to be declining over time unless we index that equalizing factor. The drop between 2008 and 2009 is just because of the growth in value. No other changes there, just because it's not indexed.
Okay.
And shows how quick this is going to become an all-levy program if you don't try and up the aid involved. if you look at the printout on
this... Let me go back just for one second. Now, this, all of the, or the schools that are getting some of the state money on this are the lower ones, so not all schools in this program are getting any state money. So
right. If you turn to the printout, this one here, estimated, this one right here. Mm-hmm. If you look in that column there, the third to the last column is the aid number, and the fourth to the last column is the levy number. Aiken, for example, gets $59 per kid, and the whole amount is coming in levy. There's no aid for them. They're getting $85,000 of levy authority and $0 in aid. Whereas if you go down to the Centennial School District, which is much lower property tax base, they're going to get $97,000 of aid and have $256,000 of levy. But again, it's relatively low-value districts are the ones that are going to get the aid out of this. You turn to the second page, the Hennepin County District start in the 270s, and you can see there's no aid for any of those except for St. Anthony, New Brighton gets a small amount of aid. And then there is a column that shows the districts that are excluded from the deferred maintenance. That's almost the middle column. It says, the column headings got kind of chopped, but it says, why 2000 all facilities flag. If that's a one, those are the ones that qualify for alternative facilities and don't get this money. So Minneapolis, they get the alternative facilities levy. They're not able to get the $60 per kid under this program.
What are the other on the deferred maintenance?
Yeah.
It's one or the other.
Yep.
And obviously they're all choosing the other.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Then, here, I don't think we're going to talk about the building lease too much today. Just want to mention one point on that. You're going to hear a lot about, depending on what happens on the Board of Elections right today, the lease. One of the things on building leases, that on page 50 of the document, there's a list of what we allowed people to do leases for. And in pay, way back in 87, 88, we said if there's any reason for instructional purposes to lease space, go ahead and do it. There was a lot of controversy about this levy, and you can see these changes that happened every single year with it. And sort of work from the bottom of the table up to the top. Basically, where we are now is you can lease classroom space for up to $100 per pupil, unless you're an intermediate school district member, in which case you can get another $25 per pupil. And then there are some special lease purchase provisions that apply to districts with desegregation plans, and they can do some leasing. And that's the lease authority that the Duluth School District is intending to use to do a bunch of their building maintenance and deferred maintenance with. They're going to do this lease purchase plan. Just last Friday, the commissioner signed off on that, but there's a lot of unhappiness in Duluth about it. We'll see how it turns out. They refer to it as the red plan. They had three different color-coded plans. The board chose to go with the red plan. It's a total of $230 million of building projects. And because they're doing it through building lease and some other things, they're not going to the voters with it. So you're going to hear a lot about that, regardless how that election turns out on the board up there. You're going to hear a lot about that this coming year.
But the money is being spent for maintenance, not new building projects?
Well, they've got two new buildings that they want to build. Duluth wants to close a whole bunch of sites and then wants to build two new facilities.
Okay.
And
they'll
lease
them from somebody.
Yeah, and the commissioner actually has said, I'm not issuing a review and comment on the new facilities because you don't know where they are yet. So she hasn't given authority for those. So those are technically off the calendar right now, but expected to come back on. And so you're going to hear a lot about this because there's a district that did a whole bunch of, or is potentially going to do a whole bunch of building repair and deferred maintenance work without having to go to the voters. So again, you get to the central question, should building projects go to the voters, and under what exceptions should they not?
And here's a district that is trying to find a loophole to avoid going.
That's how some are going to view it, yep, absolutely, yep, yep. So that's sort of what we had planned. There's a couple other little programs in here, including the telecommunications program, relatively small amount of money that's in that. We can talk to you more in detail about that. That's almost all money for Greater Minnesota, very little of the telecommunications internet access money goes to the metro area, there aren't anywhere near the same cost in the metro area for those kinds of programs, and it's wrapped around the federal E-rate program as well. So with that, that gets us to about 4. We thought today we'd give you a bunch, give you some background and give you a chance to figure out where you want to go next. So you don't have to tell us today, but.
Yeah, well, thank you guys. Certainly a listening process there.
How do you keep all this in your head?
Not quite enough.
That's the big secret. Both of you.
I get up where I'd like to go, and Johnny can very disagree with what it would be like, but I guess that I'd like to talk to districts that are having problems with the current system. I'd also like to find somebody that likes the current system and says this is a good thing. I don't know who that would be, other than possibly the taxpayer, maybe something like that, that likes to force everybody to vote on this. And so I guess that's what I'd like to see in the next one, and then in the third one, look at what other options do we have. You know, if we brought in a group of people, whether one at a time or as a group, like the superintendent's group, for example, that, you know, if you could draw up the program to build a school, how would you do it?
Yeah.
And hear what they have to say, as well as, you know, any other group, can, you know, taxpayers, they can come in and tell us what they'd like to see. So, just hear what all of them have to say as far as what they would like us to do. The next meeting, I think we're talking about either one or Ogilvy, right?
Coming up there.
Yeah. So, and then the third one will be down in Randy Demers area. So this one's in your area.
Maura? In my area?
No, this one's this one.
Thank you.
So I guess that's kind of what I've got in mind, and I'm certainly open to other suggestions if anyone, you know, is something different that we need to look at, but I guess that's kind of what I thought. Does that make sense?
Okay. And just if you're aware, the vacuum effort request from Red Lake is going to be something that the committee you'll need to deal with, and then you're going to get these cooperative facility grants. And you're probably going to get a number of just plain capital requests where someone says, hey, why don't you give us $10 million to do something nice, whether it's for a library or a school building or a community center. And the community center stuff, some of that may go through Nora's committee, or some of it may even go through the Economic Development Committee. But it's all sort of the same pot of money. You know, everybody's looking at the state bond proceeds this year to say, well, what's the highest and best use of that? Is it remodeling the Capitol? Is it building bridges? Is it redoing school buildings? And those are all
quite more housing.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. Yep.
All right.
Okay.
Well, very good. Thank you very much. And we'll let you know when the next meeting is.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we're at least on the favorite.
Yeah, the complexity of this thing, you just wonder if it sprinkles or is it all essential?
Well, my view of this is it's basically when you can't afford to do the whole ball of wax, people say, okay, well, what's the most critical thing to do? I mean, I don't think there's any policy reason why big schools can do the first thing and little schools can't. I mean, that's just simply, if we let everyone do it, it's too expensive. So what are we going to do about it? Or, so I think almost all of these, and if we had a totally comprehensive ability to do deferred maintenance, you wouldn't need any of these other little programs, basically. So, I mean, it's sort of, but then somebody says, okay, well, we can't do that, but we can do $5 million this year. What can we do? Or we can do deferred maintenance of up to $60 per kid for the other. Okay, we do that. So, I mean, you sort of get some of these things built around the edge. You'd never design it like this way off the top.
But the big part would probably still be there. The big part, which is, okay, do we want school facilities created locally, designed locally, approved locally? You know, we probably still keep that part, and then maybe have a different equalization scheme that's a lot simpler and a lot more state aid in it. But I think it's not at all clear to me that people in this state would say, oh, we'd rather have the department say, here's one of the four school buildings you can choose from. You choose the four you want for your area, and we'll pay you a bunch for it. Or to have the state say entirely, like in California, basically, create a public authority to put up school buildings and wait for the public authority to say, well, I guess you're crowded enough to get a new facility this year. You know, so I think we probably have kind of the system we want, but the things that are limiting on it, if we got rid of those limits, people say, yeah, that we don't need all these little programs.
I was wondering about, you know, doing that scenario you were talking about in California for places where they've tried to pass it and they can't.
Yeah.
Then can the school board ask somebody to come in, analyze the situation from the state, and the state says, you know what, your building is, you know, it's a health hazard, or your building's square footage is half what it needs to be, your referendum building voted down. Since it is such a huge need, we're going to give the local board the authority to do whatever they want to.
Yeah,
because you haven't voted to do it.
Yeah, and the risk you run with that is once you do something like that, then people can say, if we fail it five times, then we'll get in that program. So yeah, we'll vote it out.
But it doesn't necessarily have to be any state money.
Yeah, but even still, I think you'd find a lot of gaming on that. We have had some problem facilities in the state that have been just absolutely horrific. The last really, really bad one was the Bagley facility, where the commissioner or some group from the department was up there every year for 10 years in a row saying, you got to do something. This facility is so bad. You can't just put pallets up on the basement floor. They continually had sewage flooding, so they just put stuff on pallets so that, you know, the first 2 inches weren't affected. I mean, and that went on for years before finally they passed a bond issue up in Bagley. And we do run into those situations. I think, you know, we're getting close to that in the Wells situation. And
I thought it was Wells that was up here last year and showed pictures of their school, and they, how many, 4 or 5 times they've tried
they're going to be one that's going to ask you for state assistance, saying basically you got to do something because we just don't have the ability to pass them.
Weren't they one of the schools that you were talking about in the consolidation?
Yep, they did the right thing too. They had four school districts come together. I think it was Keister Walters, mm-hmm. Delavan, I think Wells, and what was the other one? One other down there, Elmore maybe, all came together to form the Wells District. They've closed buildings. They've tried to close buildings. But part of that is, you close the building, the people in that part of the community are never going to vote for the school again because they're mad that their local school got closed.
Yeah, right.
So they're in a real mess.
Well, what we saw happen out in North Dakota was, when that happened, a lot of times there were 3 or 4 schools, and it's okay, let's, you know, instead of picking which one we close and which one we keep open, let's build a new one in the middle.
Yeah. Yep.
And that kind of made everybody happy. The downside is that you probably have facilities that would have worked fine, you know, without doing that, without the building. But you still gain so much efficiency by putting them all into one that it's still.
And that was the initial goal of the Cooperative Secondary Facilities Grant. And two of those buildings really did go in the sort of the cornfield schools in the middle between them. The one in the Lacaparra one is built. It's between Milan, it's south of Appleton, it's north of Madison. So that was, you know, it was right at the intersection of a road where there was nothing else there. It was in the most convenient part of the district, and they're slowly closing the other schools around it. They were fortunate that the Madison school burnt down, and they had the insurance proceeds they could use for part of the cost of this, and the people in Madison were okay with giving up their local school.
When you start a tornado when you need one.
Yeah. But that's one of the things that happened, though, after the first few years of those schools, is people start saying, hey, wait a minute, why are we building schools where there's no infrastructure? You know, we're building them where there's no sewer, we're building them outside of the city limits. Wouldn't it be better to do it some other way? And so then the last couple of those, actually, ACGC and Blue Earth were both in the communities of the bigger communities. That Blue Earth worked well. ACGC, the community at Water Cosmos Grove City, which is over by the Wilmer area, they've had a terrible go of it. They've just been, their consolidation has been a disaster, in part because of that facility location process. Blue Earth has gone very smooth. Lacaparra's been very smooth. but that is one thought about it. But again, part of the process in Minnesota is we don't tell anyone who to go with. You know, we don't say Alden, you know, you're 2 miles from the Albert Lee district, just go over there. Instead, you can say, hey, that's a big district, we're scared of them, we're going to go 10 miles the other way out of our way to this little district that's like that.
Yeah, but we see that up, you know, in Sandstone, where, who was it? Finlayson, which is north and west of Sandstone, what they would think.
Yep.
And I don't know if the districts are even connected.
No, they're not.
Or not.
They're
so
not.
It's like you got an island up here,
yep,
and an island here. Together.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, all because they wanted to avoid the other community.
But somebody said, no, we'll keep your elementary school open. And the other said, well, we don't know if we will or not. And they go, well, then we're going with you. You know, and that was it.
Yeah.
And they kept it open. So.
And that gets to the siting decision, it's not an issue you probably face this next year, but 5 years out from now, we're going to have a lot of communities in greater Minnesota, particularly the southwest part of the state, that just don't have the student population to support a school anymore. And we really don't have a good process for the state to say, okay, here's what we need to do. Instead, we're sort of leaving it all to them to figure out and saying, well, go join your neighbor if you want. There's a little consolidation aid if you do that. But we are going to get some schools built out there that are not going to be in the right places. And part of it, a bit of an arms race. You know, if you've got two facilities, they both kind of run down, and you know you can get a facility as fast. You build the facility when it's time to consolidate. You can say, you know, we'd love to come over there, but we've got the brand new school. Come on over our way. So.
Yeah. Yep. If you get a school hanging on long enough, then they build one.
Yep.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.